But if you really want to turn lead into gold or hydrogen into helium, better go into space. Ellie Sanson does this every day. But when I was reunited with this incredibly enterprising tracker of space objects, she'd just been to Cooper Pedy via Japan. Cooper Pedy, what was it like for you?
Hot. It was an amazing experience. But getting to work with an international space agency such as JAXA was an amazing opportunity, and the scientists we were working with in Japan as well were just absolutely fantastic. And it was just an honour to be able to represent them and get all of their equipment out so that together we could all get the science behind the Hayabusa 2 re-entry, which is really exciting.
And we'll come to that, but you see, Cooper Pedy is normally recognised for opals. In other words, you've got to dig the stuff out because it's been there for about a billion years. What's special about it from your point of view?
It's a pretty magical place. The surrounding landscape is beautiful. A lot of people go up there for the breakaways, which is an incredible place to go for sunrise and sunset. All the people are really good fun, and going around the stations there and talking to the locals, they're all really passionate about what they do and really excited about our science too, which was really nice to have a chat to them about.
Yeah, what was happening in the sky?
So we were there as a group going to observe the Hayabusa 2's sample return capsule come back to Earth. So Hayabusa 2 is a Japanese mission that went all the way out into the solar system to an asteroid Ryugu, and it collected a sample of that asteroid, and it came back to Earth and it dropped that sample over South Australia. And it's actually the Hayabusa 2 craft itself has gone on for bigger and better things, and it's still out there.
Amazing, came back and just did a delivery and chuffed off.
It's even more incredible. It gave a delivery and it came in within the seconds of its predicted time and within the predicted landing area as well. And it was just incredible to see how they managed to manipulate that so well. It was just perfect.
And what was in the package?
So we had, well, a bit more than just dust and grains of this asteroid Ryugu, and they're going to be looking at that for trying to help us figure out a little bit more about how that kind of asteroid might have formed. And it's thought to actually be maybe one of the parent bodies of carbonaceous chondrite meteorites on Earth. So carbonaceous chondrites are a certain type of meteorite that we find. They're actually quite rare, but they contain organics and might even, and some people think, contribute to the building blocks of life here on Earth.
It's a very famous one some time ago. Landed in Victoria, did it not?
It did, the Murchison one, just over 50 years ago now, yeah.
That slight smell it's got of organic stuff, of, you know, as if something's been spilled in the garage.
Yeah, I've never actually smelt it myself. I'd really like to get a chance to do that. But I went to the 50th anniversary of the Murchison meteorite fall a couple of years ago in Murchison, and that was really amazing to hear all the witness statements and how potent that smell was, yeah.
Right, in front of me there is something, a small box, which looks quite manageable, actually. It's got a name. What am I looking at?
You are looking at a raspberry shake and boom. This is something that you can buy as an amateur. It's got inside it a little geophone and a infrasound microphone. So basically this gets placed on the ground. You can buy one to put on your desk and you can connect it up to your computer and it will record the shaking of your desk or the ground as you're walking around. And we put them out to try and listen for the sonic boom coming from that sample return capsule of the Hayabusa 2.
Why do you want to know that and hear it?
So when these things come through the atmosphere, they're going really, really fast, and we want to try and figure out the energy that these things are putting into the atmosphere. That's actually slightly related to the size of the object. So when we have a natural object, so a meteoroid coming through our atmosphere from outer space, we don't know how big it is, and we want to be able to figure out its size and whether it might have dropped something on the ground. And the best way to do that is to figure out its energy. And the Hayabusa 2 sample return capsule was basically a pre-planned man-made fireball. We knew the exact size, we knew when it was coming in, we knew its shape, we knew its speed, we knew all of these normally unknown parameters about it. So we can kind of use that now to maybe calibrate our understanding of what natural objects would sound like.
And you can work out from that, what, not just the size, but perhaps where it came from?
With the Desert Fireball Network, we've got cameras all the way across Australia taking pictures of these really, really bright shooting stars called fireballs. And the idea is that from those different viewpoints, we can figure out where in the atmosphere they come through. And if we know their size, we could figure out whether something might have landed, and we can backtrack to figure out where it came from. But sometimes we don't have those visuals, we don't have direct observations. But around the world, there are quite a lot of these seismic networks. We have quite a lot of these infrasound arrays around as well. And we want to try and figure out if we can recreate those trajectories from the sound, as well as just being able to see the fireball directly with our eyes.
So you've got not only very, very expensive equipment, flash stuff that's just been produced, but you've got this rather more down-home material that, well, the great thing is you can afford it.
Yeah, so we actually put these out alongside the professional equipment provided to us by our Japanese colleagues, and we wanted to test how well these work compared to the professional equipment and whether we can actually, as you said, we can afford lots of them. So if we've got about 50 cameras all the way across Australia, the idea is maybe if these don't cost too much, we can actually go and put one of these at each of our camera sites and add to the data that we're getting for these fireballs.
Which brings us to the point of whether you can actually use citizen science in this, because when you've got equipment, some of it, of course, is cheap enough, but other stuff, well, you don't want anyone interfering with it. And can you have citizen science people entrusted with stuff that lands and your precious objects, or do you want to keep it secret?
No, it's amazing to get people excited, and space and what we do with fireballs and shooting stars really, really does get people excited. And I love using that to kind of promote STEM and get people excited about how they can get involved. And searching for these meteorites is one of the hardest parts of what we do. It's one of the simplest, but it's one of the hardest parts to achieve, because even though we can triangulate a fireball in the atmosphere and figure out where it lands, we've still got a 1 to 2 square kilometre area that we have to search. And if we can get volunteers and helpers involved in that, that's always really helpful. The interesting thing, though, is that a lot of these will land on farmers' lands, and we do have to be a little bit careful about not just anybody walking onto land and having a search themselves, just making sure that when we do go out for a recovery trip that we have got all the permissions that we need, be it station land or Aboriginal land, we need to make sure that we've got the right permission to go out and search.
I've always wondered, while you're doing this, obviously you're trying to work out something about the history of the galaxy and the solar system especially. I often wonder whether it's telling you anything really surprising these days when you've got so many satellites and explorers and giant telescopes and you've got material landing. How many times do you get something that's really making you go, gosh, that's different?
Well, what's really interesting about what we're doing is trying to get the large number statistics involved. So although we've got about 60,000 meteorites in collections around the world that all have some really unique chemistries, we rarely know where in the solar system they're coming from. Some of them we can match to planets. We actually have pieces of Mars on my colleague's desk here.
Just over there?
I think it might be upstairs in the desiccator, but she does sometimes have it on her desk. But we can match those two known planetary bodies, but most of them we don't know where they're actually coming from. And we can use telescopes to look at asteroids in our solar system and try and match the chemistries that we get there. But actually, that's much harder to do than you think. What we're seeing with telescopes is very, very different to what we see in the meteorite collection in the world. And so trying to match those together is quite a big missing link. And the other thing we want to try and get at with these large numbers is what's actually hitting Earth and what could be a hazard, not just for figuring out solar system history. As we've discussed a few times with meteor showers, you've got basically a comet going around the solar system. It leaves a trail of gas and dust. When we go through it, we see this lovely meteor shower, but that's really, really small particles, and then it's just pretty. But we've never actually proven really the presence of a stream of asteroidal material, so this much, much bigger material. And we had back in 2012 the Chelyabinsk event, beginning of 2013, which was a really large meteoroid came over in Russia, and it did quite a lot of damage to infrastructure, to people, and it did drop a big rock on the ground as well in the lake. And we don't see those things coming. They're too small for regular telescopic surveys. We do know where all the huge world-ending ones are, but the ones that can still cause damage to buildings and people, we really don't know. So trying to put together a map of not only where this material has come from, but if there's any clustering of that material, if there's certain areas of the solar system we should really be focusing those telescopes on to watch out for hazardous events.
So we still need Bruce Willis, but we also need you.
Hopefully one day we'll be able to put this to really good use.
Such enthusiasm. You'll find Dr. Ellie Sanson at the Space Science and Technology Centre at Curtin University when she's not in Cooper Pedy or somewhere in the Nullarbor.